Let's call this meeting to order. And where's the minutes? I'm going to pass them so you don't blow me up. March 6th. Representative Lemire, I'm sure you read the minutes of March 6th. Do you want to move them?
I will move them, Mr. Chair.
All in favor of that motion, signify by saying any other questions or concerns about the minutes for March 6th. None? All in favor of the motion to approve the minutes of March 6th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes carried. Which one are we on here? Okay. Let's take House File 2485. Representative Howes, this is your bill. Pardon me? Just can't wait to be enlightened.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would move 2485 and then to be laid over for consideration in the capital investment omnibus.
Well.
And we have people here.
I see that.
That would like to talk about the bill. So I'm going to ask those that we're going to talk about the bill to come up and talk about the bill.
Very well. Would you like to move the bill?
I just did, Mr.
Chairman.
Oh, did
you? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. You wanted to move.
No, that's not helpful. I have a question.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, and for the bill author, how does the bonding chair feel about this bill?
Very important question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I'm going to deliberate on it a great deal when it gets to my committee.
Okay. Commissioner, welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Bill number 2485, which Representative Howes has introduced, is actually a standalone bill that has exactly the same language as is contained in the governor's bonding bill, but the dollar amounts are slightly different. So in the presentation that's in your package, you will see the numbers that are in the governor's bill. The numbers that are in Representative Howes' bill are slightly higher and are the numbers that we actually requested of the governor. So just to clarify why you might be seeing two different sets of asks here today.
Of course, you're advocating for the governor's numbers. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to keep everybody completely confused.
We are.
I've had the pleasure of appearing before this committee last year, and just wanted to remind you very briefly about Minnesota housing. We've been around for 40 years, and we are the state's affordable housing financial institution. We've helped hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans and invested over $1 billion into housing in Minnesota over those 40 years. The most important thing about the way we work is that we do almost nothing directly. We work through key partners, whether they be lenders or housing developers or social service providers or mortgage lenders. All of those are folks that live and work in your communities and deliver the agency's programs. If I can have you turn to page number 3 of the PowerPoint presentation, our request at either dollar amount is in two pieces. The first piece is for a set of bonds called housing infrastructure bonds. These would be available to projects for three reasons that I'll talk about in a minute. To parties that own and manage affordable rental housing, be they public or private entities, and $7 million in general obligation bonds to make capital investments in public housing. The $7 million in GO bonds would have to be used only by public entities, such as public housing authorities. And you'll hear from my colleagues more about that.
We have one thing we have to do. You know, in order for this to be remembered 100 years from now in the Historical Society, you have to give your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Tingerthal. I'm Commissioner at Minnesota Housing.
We all knew that.
Thank you. Wouldn't want the folks 100 years from now to be confused.
I don't either.
Just a point, and that is that this proposal is not for specific projects, but rather if the dollars are included in the bonding bill, they would be awarded on a competitive basis. Turning to page 4, we have worked together with a variety of groups that work in affordable housing throughout the state to identify 3 critical needs for these affordable housing bond proceeds. The first would be the preservation of existing federally assisted rental housing, whether it's privately or publicly owned, and we have representatives here today to talk about both of those. The second would be to stabilize communities that are hard hit by the foreclosure crisis. This is something we've been working on for a number of years, and hopefully we're coming closer to the end of that crisis, but there is still much work to be done. And one of the uses there would be the purchase of land for community land trusts. And finally, the provision of supportive housing. This is a use of this type of bond that the agency has done before. There was an allocation of bonding authority of this type in 2008, and all of those proceeds have been placed. Turning to page 5, just a brief introduction of how this program would work, should it be included in the bill. Housing infrastructure bonds would be awarded through a competitive process, and the 4 main items that we would look at in each of the proposals would be readiness to proceed. We think it's important that these dollars be put to service as quickly as possible. The leverage of non-state resources, meeting the targeted priorities, the 3 that we just talked about, and that they show a demonstrated need. Just for all of you who don't know how the Housing Finance Agency does its day-to-day business, we actually run a competition every year for proceeds for both rental housing and for certain of our home ownership programs, and have a selection process that has points and is competitive, and we typically get about 4 times as many eligible projects as we are able to fund. We get high marks from our partners as to the transparency and the fairness of our process, and we would anticipate that these funds would be awarded and that projects could be ready to start by the end of this year. Housing that receives these bond proceeds has to be kept affordable for a minimum of 20 years. Similar bonds, as I mentioned, were authorized in 2008, and the agency has had no allocation of bonding authority since then. Out of the 2008 dollars, there were 7 projects with 400 units, and those were all supportive housing units in the that were funded. That was 3 in Greater Minnesota and 4 in the metro area. So lest you should think that all of these projects go in the metro area, very much not the case. Out of dollars that were used, GO dollars for public housing, there were 10 projects that were funded for 686 units. Of that, only 3 were in the metro area and 7 were in Greater Minnesota. Finally, on page 6, just a few renderings and pictures of the types of projects that may be financed. Again, these are not specific projects that are being requested, but indicative of the types of projects that are waiting in the pipeline that could compete for these funds. We have photos here of Lutheran Social Services, Center for Changing Lives in Duluth, and we do have a speaker on that topic. Common Bond, a housing developer nonprofit here in the metro area, has been notified by the Veterans Administration of the availability of essentially free land to build a project at Fort Snelling and one in St. Cloud. The Community Land Trusts have a long relationship with the agency, and there are still many opportunities for acquiring vacant properties that are vacant or abandoned properties that could be put into a community land trust. I was just in Rochester yesterday and saw some of the work that has been done there with the Community Land Trust. Also has been very active in North Minneapolis. And finally, the preservation of federally assisted housing. And we do have a speaker on that today as well. So with that, Mr. Chair, I am finished with my presentation. I'd be happy to take questions, or if you prefer to take the testimony of the other speakers, I'd be happy to return to the table for questions later.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Commissioner. I was just, the Community Land Trust has an idea that's been around for a while, and it seems to have met with some success. But I'm just curious, do you have any idea how many of those land trust properties there are? Is it a few hundred, or is it thousands? I'm just curious.
Senator, or Representative Stensrud, I don't know the answer to that question, but it's one that I'd be happy to follow up by email. I believe we are into over 1,000 units now, because there are active land trusts in our major cities, Rochester, a very active land trust in Duluth, as well as Minneapolis. So we'd be happy to get back to you with that answer.
Thank you.
Very well. Representative Swedinski.
Mr. Chair, kind of going along that same line of questioning, are there other bills? I think potentially Representative Clark has a land trust bill as well. Are these connected in any way? Are they on top of each other, layered, or how about is how many asks are coming through, do you figure?
Technically, this is the only ask, and the only thing in question is the dollar amount.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Mulry.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Howes, as you move along on this, I hope you'll take into account how effective the land trusts are in inner city neighborhoods that are really having a lot of problems with everything from crime to schools and some of the other things coming from MHFA aren't really helping that, but the land trusts have proven to be incredibly successful, and so I hope you will really look at moving those figures up on the land trusts. I can't tell you how much benefit they are to our communities that are really hard hit by things.
So. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, I'm going to take a real hard look at it, a real close look. I'm probably going to get a little bit of heat from my caucus for overspending the governor, at least trying to. But I think it's important, like she said, since 2008 that we've done much of anything. And in last year in the special session, we had, I think it was $15 or $20 million in there for housing, and it was about quarter after midnight, and we didn't have the $800,000 of cash for the debt service, so we couldn't do anything. I am working with the tax chair to find some money to pay the debt service. Also, the governor is looking in all the drawers and cupboards over at the Capitol, and we're trying to find that, and that's the key ingredient. If we don't find the $2.2 or $2.5 million for debt service, then this isn't going to happen.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I was trying to say is if you do have to cut, make sure it's not the land trust part, because that's really what is so important to our communities that really have problems.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I'm getting advice from a lot of people.
I mean,
Representative Mahoney.
Okay, anybody else have questions? Representative Clark, I was kind of wondering.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. I'm sorry, I had to step out briefly. I just want to reinforce that discussion about the need to pay attention to the land trust. And I know that there's some negotiations going on that have to do with some technicalities regarding that. Commissioner, I hope you'll be able to work that out. The other thing I wanted to just to say, I had the opportunity to visit with some of my constituents today. And I know in the area of the supportive housing, One of the things that was raised by some of the folks that came to visit me was that some of the details on who is eligible and who are not eligible are very difficult. For it shuts out people who really need it. For example, my understanding is that in the area of persistent and mental illness, serious and persistent mental illness, some of the definitions actually exclude the people who most need it. And I'm wondering if you've heard this kind of feedback, and if not, maybe we could have a conversation more about it. But it has to do with whether or not people are able to live independently or need case management. And if they need case management, they're not eligible, and yet they need case management because by very definition of persistent mental illness, serious mental illness, they need it. So I'm just wondering, I know that money is basically spent from last year, right? But as you go forward with this, has this come forward to you as a concern?
Commissioner. Representative Clark, I have not personally heard that concern. What I would say, and just for the other members of the committee, there are many pieces that need to come together to provide a supportive housing project. This particular bill provides the money for the bricks and mortar for the building. We work very closely with the Department of Human Services, Department of Corrections, Department of Public Safety, Department of Health, all of whom have various pieces of funding that provide either services or rental assistance dollars that allow these buildings to actually operate. And so that's a piece of the supportive housing. The rental assistance is a piece that was included last year in the appropriations bill, and this is really the bricks and mortar to go with that. What I would say is that we work very closely with an interagency group called the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness, and my assistant commissioner and I have been working very closely with senior staff under each of the departments this year to really bring together the commissioners at a policy level so that we, if there are issues that really have sticky regulatory problems, that we can really tackle those at the commissioner level. So be happy to take that concern back if you'd like to give us a little more detail and see if we can get to the bottom of it.
Yes, thank you, and Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I really appreciate that, and it came out loud and strong in some discussion with people today. So if you could help me with that, that'd be great. The other thing I wanted to bring up is another bonding bill that I believe the chairman, he and I have had a conversation about this, and I'd like to see some of the resources in this bill. And I know, Commissioner, we've tried several times to get together for an appointment. I think we're meeting tomorrow rather than before this hearing today. But it has to do with trying to target some of the bonding towards a particularly vulnerable group of girls and women who are trafficked and, you know, just can't find a safe place to be. And I would like to have a discussion more about the possibility of a little set aside. It is a separate bill, and I have talked with Representative Howes about it, and we're not going to do anything in this committee on it, but it will be something that for the bonding committee we will look at. And I just want to just get that on the record here, since this is the day we're talking about it publicly, that I want to see, I know that it would fit in this kind of infrastructure bonding, and I want to make sure that we have the opportunity to talk about it some more, and that anything you might want to say about it today is fine. We haven't had our individual conversation, but I have talked with you about it briefly, and you wanted to meet with the advocates, and this is just a very serious, serious issue of people not having safe housing who are trafficked and prostituted in our area, and particularly needing some culturally appropriate type of services that just really aren't out there right now. If you could respond to that briefly, it would be fine.
Yes, Representative Clark. As we discussed briefly, the one priority, which is for supportive housing, would allow the type of financing for the type of facility that you've identified. Oftentimes in getting to new uses, it's a matter of working with organizations to get projects to the point where they are viable and ready to proceed. With supportive housing, we often find that it's it's really working with the other agencies, DHS, Department of Public Safety, for example, in the case of a shelter, to get the dollars for the services. So oftentimes when we're providing technical assistance to organizations, we often start there because that's often the harder piece of the puzzle to put together. And once those pieces are in place, we can often get the project in the queue for the bricks and mortar dollars.
Mr. Chairman, just a final comment. It's kind of a vicious circle, though. You know, as we know, if you don't have the facility, then you can't have the services, and if you don't have the services, you can't have the facility. So I really want us to talk about how those can work together.
Very well. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the witness. I'm looking on page 11, the stabilized communities hit by foreclosures. And I just want an explanation. As you know, you've got the color code on the right, my right side. Here it's got 1% to 25. So the darker areas mean that between December 2009 and December 2010, does that mean in the deep red there was 100% more foreclosures than the year before? Am I reading that right?
Representative Mahoney, yes, that is correct. We included these maps really to show that foreclosure is not just an issue in Minneapolis and St. Paul. While there are still serious issues in Minneapolis and St. Paul, the growth in foreclosures and real estate-owned properties is actually higher in areas outside the central cities right now than it is in the central cities.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, do you have any closing remarks, Representative Howes? Or would you like to renew your motion?
I would like to renew my motion that 2485 be laid over and considered in the capital investment omnibus, whatever you do to send it to my committee.
You'll be involved, I promise. Yeah. Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you.
I just discovered one thing. We had several other testifiers.
Yeah, we did.
And I apologize. If you'd like to come up and give your testimony, even though we've passed a bill, feel free to do it, because we don't want to ignore the fact that you bothered to come all the way here to testify. And you have my apologies. And if you give testimony that's going against the bill, maybe we'll have to renew it. Call back.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Potterwiltz, and I own and operate a real estate development company with a portfolio of affordable housing, primarily in outstate Minnesota, of about 1,500 units strong. And I'd like to share with you some information on the magnitude of the problem for acquisition and rehab outstate. We really have about five kinds of properties that are out there. We've got some old Rural Development Agency properties that were Farmers Home and now a Rural Development Agency. We've got some HUD properties that had different sorts of funding. A lot of them was Section 8 vouchers, which is the deepest kind of subsidy that we have in the state. Some that were MIFA mortgages that have Section 8 vouchers, and then some tax credit projects. A lot of those projects are now reaching a point in their lifespan where they need significant rehab, or they're at risk because of the ownership entity can convert them, or they're at risk because of a degradation in the actually ownership entity itself. Often they were done by folks with a civic motivation who passed on, they're owned by trusts, and the motivation is entirely different from what it was when those deals were done. The need for affordable housing in Minnesota is growing at an unprecedented rate, as you can imagine. The average household incomes in the state are declining, and this is a result of, I think, the economy as well as the type of jobs that are being created. We have a growing number of households that are expending a significant portion of their income for housing. The standard in the marketplace is about 30% of the income. Anybody who spends over more than 30% of their income is considered to be rent burdened. We've got folks in the marketplace right now in Stearns County, where I live, St. Cloud, 55% of the renters are spending over 30% of their income. Statewide, it's 17% in a recent housing study that was done by the Center for Housing Policy, where one out of every eight, or a little better than that,
are spending more than 50% of their income for housing needs. So at a time when we have decreasing incomes, we've got a growing demand. The foreclosure instance that one of the representatives asks about plays a role in this need as well. The composition in our rental pool has changed greatly. In our townhouse projects in outstate Minnesota and our general rental projects, in excess of 20%, almost 25% of the households there have been through foreclosure in the last couple of years. But you're dealing with folks that were just barely able to get into single-family homes, who are now went through the foreclosure process and have actually come back into the rental market. So you've got that growth factor. So you've got the aging of the housing units, you've got some being converted, you've got decreasing incomes, you've got a growing population, and you've got folks who are whose income is changing by virtue of the economy as well as the foreclosure. Another little cue in the whole thing is the fact that the foundations were great participants with Minnesota Housing Finance and with HUD and in financing properties in Minnesota for low and moderate income people. With the recessionary economy the way we have it right now, the foundation support has all but dried up. So we've got decreasing resources, and it's a matter that you folks are all facing on the state level as well, at a time when we've got unprecedented need. It comes together at a very unusual time. And going to the need in outstate, my small shop, we're looking right now at 15 Section 8 and RDA projects. And this is just the tip of the iceberg that I know of in my shop. So if I know of 15 that are at risk of conversion, 17 tax credits in our portfolio in and around our area, and one essential fund, essential city essential function bond transaction, they're all at risk of conversion or in financial trouble or physically in need of repairs. So if those are the magnitude of deals that I know about in my operation in St. Cloud, and I know that the folks from the agency or from the research staff can give you the actual numbers, but the magnitude is truly amazing in outstate Minnesota and in the metropolitan area. All but two of these 33 projects that I mentioned are located in outstate. They range in size from 18 to 135 units. They average about 30 units apiece. They range in age from 16 years old to 45 years old. They're all currently occupied by low-income housing, so for every unit you lose, you adversely affect them. The average turnover on a project like this is around 40% a year because people have the ability to move up in society and get other jobs and move on. And so if you take that multiplier at 40% a year, if you look at the number of units that this bonding deal that you're looking at with 1,250 units would do, in the life of that 20-year thing, it would affect 9,000 families. 9,000 households in Minnesota could be bettered by the successful consideration of that project. We have had success. We've done seven of these transactions. We did Redwood Falls, Melrose, Sauk Rapids, Albert Lea, St. Cloud, and Waite Park. They were all at-risk transactions. We did these with the assistance of Minnesota Housing, HUD, and RDA, and the local communities. And I'd support your support of the bill at the higher level. Thank you for your time. If I can answer any questions, I'd be glad to.
I have one question. With the rental income, the 30% from the people that occupy your units, plus the HUD subsidy, is that not enough to keep money there to maintain and keep your housing units up to date?
Well, there's like five different kinds of housing units. Some of those that with the tax credits, you know, that's a different category. Only a portion of them, and what portion it is, have Section 8. My guess is it's less than 15% statewide. Mm-hmm. It's only a guess, sir. So you're only talking about income support on a portion of those units. The balance of the people have to be aimfully employed. They're not deep subsidy programs. They're paying that income, or that rent, excuse me, out of their income, which greatly reduces their disposable income. That's why the rent burden issue is so important. When you're looking at somebody who has a lesser income, any rent of any magnitude is going to put them at a deficit.
So you're talking about people that kind of fall through the cracks.
We're really, it's the workforce housing. It's the people who are at the edge, who are, you know, families in formation. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yeah, would you like to testify, sir? Your name for the record.
Yes, sir. My name is John Ford. I'm the executive director of the Housing and Redevelopment Authority out of Albert Lea, Minnesota. Want to thank you all for taking time to hear our discussion today about the request for state bonding authority that will provide affordable housing opportunities all across the state of Minnesota. Specifically, I've been asked to address the request for general obligation bonds for rehabilitation of public housing. In your package, you have a map that indicates where our public housing units are located in Minnesota. You can see that we have units located virtually in every legislative district in the state. There are 124 agencies that manage over 20,300 units of public housing, and they're located in 210 communities throughout Minnesota. These units serve low and moderate income families, and the majority of our tenants are elderly and disabled. Governor Dayton included a request, certainly, of $7 million for the GO bonds for the public housing rehab, and Representative Howes came up and offered a little bit more, which we're obviously very excited about, bringing that total to $10 million. Our public housing facilities have been well-maintained over the years, but 57% of the buildings in public housing now are at age 35 or older, and they continue to age. The operating margins in public housing are not adequate to cover the cost of major rehabilitation, such as roofs, boilers, elevators, and window replacement throughout these buildings. The general obligation bond funds would be administered by Minnesota Housing, and Minnesota Housing would evaluate those proposals from the housing authorities that represent the greatest need, that offer projects that are now ready to go, and which leverage the most non-state funding as well. In May of 2008, the Minnesota Housing Partnership did a study of the condition of the public housing units in the state, and while we realize we have assets worth over $2 billion, the backlog of capital improvements were estimated at a little more than $300 million. Now, 4 years later, coupled with a decline in funding at the federal level, the public housing assets are in need of state help to continue to be a viable source of affordable housing. Previous state investment for our agency, for example, in Albert Lea, allowed us to fully fund the replacement of the air exchange units in our building. These units had been inoperable for a period of about 15 years. We just simply were not able to gather enough funding at one time to replace them as the cost was fairly high. We were able to access state public housing preservation money. We combined those with other grant resources and operational resources, and that allowed us then to replace that equipment. The end results for our people and for our buildings was that we were able to promote better and healthier air quality and more energy efficiency of the heating and cooling systems in the building as well. This project not only provided that improvement in the lives of these families, but also provided some significant local economic impact and employment opportunities for local contractors and subcontractors in our community. Without these funds, we simply would not have been able to do this project. The cycle of general obligation bonds will help repair or replace low-quality windows, replace inefficient heating systems, repair roofs, bring elevators into compliance, and to make these properties a viable source of housing for low-income families in Minnesota. I want to thank you again for allowing me to speak here today. And if you have any questions, certainly I can answer as best I can.
Any questions? Representative Clark is first.
I can wait.
Okay. Representative Murray.
Well, I'd just like to say that Mr. Ford represents a fine community in Albert Lea, and I'm glad to have him up here today. He's been a wealth of information for me, learning a lot about the housing throughout the state of Minnesota. And what I found real interesting is even when he's not looking for a particular benefit within Albert Lea for this program, it's to benefit all of Minnesota, and he's working hard for all of that. So I appreciate that, and thanks for coming up and sharing with us today.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say again to Mr. Ford, I really appreciate your testimony, and I hope everybody was listening. You know, this $10 million we're talking about for public housing is about 1/20 of what we need, right? I mean,
yes.
Well, I actually used the 300. Yeah.
300.
Last time I heard it was 200, now it's 300. I mean, this is a important step, but it isn't by any means what the need is. And I just would like to reemphasize that, because what we're talking about here, again, a lot of our elders, a lot of people with disabilities, we all have these housing units in our communities, every single one of us. And if you've been in these buildings, you can see that they need repair. They need remodeling. They leak. They fall apart. There's a lot of good efforts, I think, being done by our local communities, but at some point they just need to have the dollars invested in it. So I just think, you know, it's such a modest request, and I thank you, Representative Howes, for raising it a tiny bit, $3 million more. That's great. We could eventually, you know, make this even a much bigger program, and it would put lots of people to work. This is the kind of construction opportunities that, you know, I don't even know what the number is. Do you know, have there been an estimate, if we were to just begin to do the repairs that were needed in our public housing infrastructure with this Varneyville, and let's say if we actually had the full amount needed, how many jobs will we be creating? Do you know how many construction jobs?
Representative Clark, thank you for your question. I really would have a hard time estimating. I can tell you, if you give me $300 million, I can hire a lot of people. We can do a lot of work. So, I mean, if you want to sign it over today, I'm good. I really couldn't make an estimate. I can tell you that in the project that we did in Albert Lea, by the time it was over, was a little over $500,000. I know that we had a general contractor. We had multiple subcontractors that worked on it. I would say that it's hard to measure how many jobs were created, but I can tell you that some jobs were retained at that time because of the economic situation for a lot of our contractors. And I know we had at least 60 people in and out of that building one time or another just on this project.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is one of those other $300-some million construction projects that maybe should be before us. I mean, we have a different one that we'll be looking at, I guess, here at the legislature. So I just and it has permanent and long-lasting effects for the people who are our neighbors and who live in our community. So thank you for bringing that forward.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have two more people wanting to testify. Again, I apologize. I hope the results are what you wanted, that we handle with the bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Vorbach with the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, and I will speak briefly about the tight rental market in Southwest Minnesota, tight to non-existent rental market for affordable housing in places like Worthington, Jackson, Austin, Mankato, Redwood Falls, Montevideo. So currently places like JBS, the pork processor in Worthington, is busing people in. Employees in from Sioux Falls. Also in Worthington last summer, we opened 30 units of affordable housing in Worthington, and before the construction was completed, we had all 30 units rented and had to turn away 50 more applicants. There's a place called AGCO in Jackson that's trying to hire 30 welders, and they were able to find 24 welders interested in coming, but it didn't pan out because there wasn't sufficient housing that these welders wanted to live in. So this bill, by taking the pressure off the affordable housing market, can help economic recovery in that employers won't be as frustrated in trying to find housing for their employees, and employers will be more willing to come to that part of the state and take jobs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you say that they're busing people in from Sioux Falls to Worthington to work. What is Sioux Falls doing different that they have excess housing or appropriate housing and Worthington or Minnesota is not doing?
That's a good question, Representative Mahoney. I honestly don't know. I can't speak off the top of my head as to what they're doing differently. I'm guessing Sioux Falls might be a bigger, just being a bigger metropolis, is able to absorb more people, but I honestly don't know what is different between Sioux Falls and Worthington that they have enough housing.
I think some of it might be we're talking about workforce housing, the housing you're talking about in Jackson and probably Worthington. People making $12 an hour can't afford to build a house. Maybe Sioux Falls have fewer as a percentage jobs that are in that category. We went to Thief River Falls, the commissioner and a bunch of us did, and we discussed workforce housing, and it's got a critical need. for exactly what you said. Jackson will be in my district if I get reelected. And I look forward to trying to help them, maybe work with you, to get some housing for AGCO's workforce, as well as many other businesses that are in Jackson. Jackson's kind of on a boom. Worthington's always been there, never had enough housing. Pipestone, Suzlon shrunk and almost went away because we didn't have affordable workforce housing. So there's a lot of tremendous needs, and we're going to try to find a template. The commissioner and I are, and we're going to try to make it work. We lost a lot with HUD housing going away. Sir, would you give your name for the record?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Pat Connolly. I'm speaking both as a new dad and as the Housing Development Director at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. I'll speak just briefly to the project the commissioner pointed out as a potential type of building that could use these bonds. LSS is one of the largest, oldest human service organizations in the state. Last year, about 100,000 people were touched by our service, and some of those were receiving it, and some of that number were those that were giving it. I'm kind of happy to be in kind of both categories. We work with a lot of homeless youth, so I'll speak specifically to that. Right now, the project that was on the commissioner's materials that she handed out, we're anticipating or hoping for a partnership with First Lutheran Church in Duluth, where we would build what we're going to call, hopefully, the Center for Changing Lives in Duluth. It would be modeled after the Center for Changing Lives that we built in South Minneapolis. The Duluth project would consolidate all of the youth and family services that we currently provide in Duluth, and it would also contain 20 units of housing for homeless or runaway kids. Having my daughter Tilly is 2 years old, having her has kind of opened my eyes in new ways to the plight of what some of these kids are going through. I'll just briefly tell you the story about this kid named Sean, who was he went through our program in Duluth. So he lived in this town called Finland, which I guess is about 70 miles northeast of Duluth. His mom was abusing drugs, I guess, and she just abandoned the family, and then his dad was abusive to him. And the part I can't even fathom, he figured his best option was to hop on his bike and go down Highway 61 to try to get to Duluth to find a safe place to live. And the story, as I've heard him tell it, is that he got about halfway and he ran into a police officer in Two Harbors, kind of, you know, asked him what was going on, and eventually referred him to our Renaissance program in Duluth, where he completed his GED. He figured out how to take care of himself and cook for himself and find an apartment, take care of an apartment, and then he eventually spent a year in our program, and he moved out into a market rate apartment with a buddy of his. There's a lot of reasons too why kids like Sean find themselves feeling like they've got to bike down Highway 61 to get to a better place. They age out of foster care and their families can't afford to take care of them anymore. They realize or come out as being gay or lesbian, and their parents kick them out of the house. And sometimes the parents just can't afford to take care of them. And as a dad, I just can't imagine that kind of thing happening to my daughter. So that's basically why I'm here speaking, I guess, now in thanks for you continuing on the potential for these bonds. And in specifically the Duluth project, if these bonds make it through, LSS will be applying in this competitive process for $3 million. That'll help to pay for the housing component of that building. And the other $7 million, which will, I guess that $3 million will help leverage, we'll come up with that in a combination of a capital campaign and hopefully some private equity. And the building, in addition to the housing units, it would contain a crisis nursery. We'd help do parenting classes there. We would do truancy and runaway outreach and prevention. And then independent living skills for kids aging out of foster care. And we also do supervised visits for parents who have lost custody of their kids. So that's the specifics behind the project that we hope to see happen there. And if I can try to answer any questions, I will.
Seeing no questions, sounds like a very worthwhile project.
Thank you
for bringing it up. And now we can go on to the next bill, House File 2606. Representative Hausman, welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2606 for possible inclusion in our bonding bill.
Very well. Thank you. Would you like to tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being willing to hear our bill. This House File 2606 appropriates money for the expansion of the University Enterprise Laboratories building. You have a copy, I believe, in your folders of some quick facts about this. Just very briefly, UEL is a nonprofit bioscience incubator located in St. Paul between the Minneapolis and St. Paul campuses of the University of Minnesota. It incubates small bioscience companies, many of them coming out of the University of Minnesota. Opened in 2005, it is full, has already a demand for 30,000 square feet. It's seeking to add 40,000 with state bonding, a total cost of $24 million. Half of that would come from the state, and they would raise the other half. The important point to make, I think, is that these are bioscience jobs created, 325 of them, support jobs, 1,300, and the average pay is $58,000 a year. It's a very nice kind of job to attract. And I am joined today by Tony Carideo, Chairman of the Board, who will speak briefly to the bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
My name is Tony Carideo, and I am the chairman of the board of University Enterprise Laboratories. And I am here to testify in favor of House File 2606, a bonding proposal to provide 50% of the funding for the construction of a 30 to 40,000 square foot addition to University Enterprise Laboratories in St. Paul, Minnesota. I am a volunteer. Our entire board is made up of volunteers, individuals and corporate and civic leaders who dedicate valuable time to this facility, to this idea, because they believe in it, because they believe that entrepreneurship and capital formation in this state are vitally important to Minnesota's economic health. And facilities like University Enterprise Laboratories lie at the very heart of that process. UEL is home to 21 early-stage life sciences companies, including several promising companies born in laboratories at the University of Minnesota. It's one of the state's shining examples of a public-private partnership. It's also a little engine that could, one that has survived and indeed prospered against all odds, difficulties at first in finding tenants, and of course, through one of the nation's most bruising economic downturns. Our facility with 109,000 square feet of rentable space is 101% occupied. We've even rented out a portion of our maintenance facility. The more than 260 scientists, technologists, other highly compensated people who pass through our doors each day are engaged in cutting-edge science and health service endeavors. They arrive at this workplace from all over the state. Minneapolis and St. Paul and the suburbs of these two cities. We have two people who commute from Willmar, as well as employees from Farmington, Hugo, and Lake Elmo. One of our companies, Centurion, is owned by a Willmar poultry farmer, and another, Selectus, is considering expansion into outstate Minnesota, where it sees the potential of buying more than 500 acres of farmland to continue its work in plant sciences. What we do at UEL is remarkable. Ativa Medical, for example, is an early stage company developing an advanced medical diagnostics system. Kingfisher Biotech is developing and commercializing veterinary chemicals reagents for species underserved in the commercial market. Centurion, which I mentioned a moment ago, is developing vaccines to prevent staph infections, salmonella, and clostridium, to name just a few. One of our fastest growing companies, Exosome Diagnostics, is focused on commercializing proprietary genetic-based diagnostics in oncology. Exosome-derived RNA testing has the potential to improve the diagnosis of new cancers, identify the occurrence of postoperative cancers, and more precisely monitor the efficacy of drug therapies. Any one of the companies in our facility could become the next Medtronic or Genentech. And several are taking their first steps in this direction. Since its founding in 2005, UEL has graduated no fewer than five companies. Our most recent graduate, a company called Optimec, started at our facility with three employees. It left a couple of months ago with five. It now has nine. Harlan Medical started with a handful of employees. It now employs 35 and is in the process of being sold to a much larger concern. The same is true with Sagittis, which started similarly small and now employs 31. UEL has survived and grown with the help of corporations such as 3M, Ecolab, Boston Scientific, Medtronic, Allina, Xcel Energy, the University of Minnesota and its foundation, and perhaps most important, the City of St. Paul, which under the leadership of then-Mayor Randy Kelly provided a city loan guarantee to back a portion of our original financing package, which totaled $17 million. This past January, UEL unwound that financing, successfully defeating the state's first ever New Markets Tax Credit, along with bonds backed by a letter of credit from Wells Fargo. We refinanced that complex structure with a simple 7-year fixed rate loan at 4.06% with U.S. Bank. That financing, totaling approximately $9.6 million, was backed by a City of St. Paul loan guarantee of $4 million, down from $6 million, which was the original guarantee amount. From UEL's early days, when we were only 50% filled and running large negative cash flows, we are now able to project comfortable positive cash flows using conservative rental assumptions. The cash we generate will allow the facility to actually reduce the city's guarantee amount over the term of the loan, while at the same time establishing substantial reserves to fund future lease rollovers, as well as a large reserve for debt service, both of which significantly improve our facility's financial strength. By the end of our loan term, we anticipate we will no longer need any city guarantee to support our credit facility. Beyond that, we project cash flows in the second and third year of our current mortgage that will generate approximately $100,000 a year, allowing UEL to continue to improve the existing facility and to provide additional shared amenities to our tenants. I would add, by the way, that prior to our refinancing, UEL paid more than $300,000 in free cash to install a long-needed, energy-efficient roof over our entire 125,000-square-foot facility. UEL is a scientific community. We provide our tenants with services and equipment to which they may not have access under separate facilities. Everything ranging from multiple autoclaves, the largest of which costs more than $37,000 for sterilizing equipment, to 80 below Celsius freezers for storing and preserving sensitive cultures, and monthly lunch and learn events to help them navigate the complexities of the regulatory environment to gain access to much needed professional services and to meet and collaborate with their colleagues in related businesses. Just this week, we opened a tenant-requested machine shop for the construction of scientific equipment and prototypes. Unfortunately, over the years, the media has repeatedly attacked UEL, arguing that it's not really an incubator, to use the conventional new business formation term, or that it's not an accelerator, another term of art in this milieu. Instead, they've demeaned the project as a real estate play, which to us is like calling Target Field a well-manicured lawn. We'd rather refer to our facility, which houses our businesses an average of only 3 years before they move on to other larger quarters, a job factory. Come visit our facility. Some of you already have. It's impressive, with a large atrium that greets its guests in a way that sends a clear signal to potential funders. The businesses in this space are serious. They're real. This is very important because the irony we face today is that Earl Bakken, who famously founded Medtronic in his garage, under current regulatory and national security strictures, would not be allowed to do that in this day and age. UEL, in answer to that reality in 2010, created a garage for very, very early stage companies, a place where brand new enterprises can set up shop using shared equipment and at a minimal cost. I'm almost done. Now UEL has the capacity to grow. We estimate that each year, as Representative Hausman said, we turn away approximately 30,000 square feet of potential new tenants. It's important to know that based on our market studies, our type of space with these amenities and features does not exist elsewhere in the Twin Cities or to any great extent outstate. Why? Because so-called wet lab space is expensive to build. Facilities with the proper chemical-resistant flooring and countertops, sophisticated chemical hoods and exhaust systems, fire protection, and other safety equipment can cost up to $330 a square foot to construct. These economics simply do not work using conventional financing alone. Add in the sometimes tenuous financial status of our tenants, and the value proposition becomes essentially impossible for lenders and developers to justify to loan committees. Hence our request for state bonding to support the addition of new laboratories and nearby office space whose rents would be within reach of these early stage companies. Policymakers talk about job creation, about economic development. As I look through the current draft of the state's bonding bill, I can't find many projects that combine both the opportunity to employ skilled craftsmen and women to construct the building, but that also result in permanent jobs. Employment opportunities that keep on giving day in and day out, year in and year out, creating a space for new ideas and a launching pad for companies that can grow and create many new jobs beyond the start they receive at our facility. The biotechnology industry estimates that a single job created at a facility such as UEL has a multiplier effect of 4 to 6 additional jobs. Here is Minnesota's opportunity to extend and amplify the model we have already built. We have created a highly successful facility, a scientific hub, a building that has succeeded in spite of considerable odds against it. Help us continue to grow. Call the UEL what you will, an incubator, a business accelerator, a jobs factory. One thing we are for sure, and that's a success story. And we ask the Minnesota legislature to add a new chapter to that story by approving the state's portion of the funding of this addition. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I would just add, as you know, we can't bond for a nonprofit without a local government partner, and the local government partner for UEL is the St. Paul Port Authority.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carrillo, this is very interesting. I just was wondering, when you say the companies stay there for an average of 3 years, I'm assuming that some stay there a short time and some stay there a longer time. So I guess I've got like three questions. One is, how long do they have as a maximum? Another one is, who decides if, you know, you've overstayed your welcome, you're not coming to market, you've got to move? And then have you considered some of these companies, if they're bought out, do they ever pay back so that you have money to add on to the building like this to make it available for other new startups? I guess there's three questions
right
there.
Let's see if I can take them one at a time. First of all, so far our move-out rate, being 3 years, has been lower than we would anticipate moving forward. We have signed leases with all of our tenants, and those leases are beginning to come up at a more rapid rate. And so I would anticipate that the move-out rate will increase, making us more of an incubator. We do not have a formal kick-out process because they sign real estate leases. Some companies fail. That's the nature of a project like this. And then they move out. But we have had, and at least recently in the last 3 or 4 years, we've been blessed with the fact that we have demand that will allow us to refill those spaces quite quickly. No, we do not have a policy. In the same way that we don't have a policy requiring that companies support their rent, or if they can't pay their rent, then we have to figure out a way to move them out of the space. We don't ask them to pay back. We believe that they pay back by creating new jobs and by growing outside the facility and by going forth and multiplying, as it were.
Any other questions? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is your handout.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Carrillo?
Carrillo, yes.
Carrillo. I was noticing one of the lines here says, when you're talking about immediate job creation, it says these jobs can never be outsourced. What do you mean by that? These companies do move out and they can go to other states, other countries. What do you mean the jobs can never be outsourced? Are you only talking about construction, or are you talking about, what are you talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, what we're talking about here are jobs that require hands-on work within laboratories. Again, I would encourage you to visit the facility. These folks are there 7 days a week, tending to cultures, tending to, we have plant sciences, veterinary sciences, and so it is very difficult to outsource these jobs to another country or another company, because so much of what they do is contained in laboratories that they're working at their companies. And so it's difficult to outsource these jobs. What we do try to help them do is outsource services. We are trying to help them, for instance, shared copying, shared secretarial services, for the lack of a better term, administrative services, so as to leverage their scientific expertise. Anything can be outsourced, of course, but these jobs are much more difficult to do that, because these are company founders who are bringing along longtime scientists and colleagues, and they are developing technologies that are protected by intellectual property that they do not want to outsource.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I wasn't clear enough. You know, so this is a public investment that we're making in these companies. We're subsidizing these companies to do their work. My question was asked because I think what we heard you in response to Representative Scalzi, these companies are, after a certain period, they're going to move out, especially if they grow. There's nothing that they don't sign a pledge to say we're going to keep the jobs that we create in Minnesota or anything like that. It's just you're talking about during the initial time that a particular company is there, that particular work is happening inside the building, I guess. Is that right? But the companies themselves certainly could move anywhere they wanted and send their jobs.
Yes, they can.
Any state, any, okay.
Yes, they can. But okay. Let me comment on that. You know, if you think about Minnesota in terms of what I used to call the Guthrie effect, the IDS effect, we are trying to create a critical mass here. We are trying to create a larger scientific community, one that grows on itself. that spawns new companies, that spins out new ideas. And when you spin out a small company, they tend to stay here. Talk to any executive recruiter, and what they call Minnesota is a dead town. And that is both a blessing and a curse. It's a dead town because it's very difficult to get people into Minnesota to work, but it's also very difficult to pry them out of here. And so once they come, they stay, they grow their businesses. I come from the investment profession, and I grew up here around some of the biggest investment companies in the world, and they have not left. And what instead they've done is that they've spawned new, smaller investment companies because people establish roots here. And you're right, they can go anywhere they want. That's free enterprise.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I have another question. I mean, I think it would be interesting just to finish that part to actually have some statistics on the small companies, where they go. Do they go to South Dakota? Do they, you know, whatever. It would just be interesting if you have that. But I'm not talking about investment companies. I'm talking about some of the bioscience.
So far, they have not left.
Okay.
All of our graduates are still here.
All of your graduate companies?
Yes, ma'am.
That'd be really interesting.
They are still in Minnesota.
Great.
And they are still in the metropolitan area.
Maybe you could show me some. I would love to see that story a little bit more.
And we can say they're not all in the metro area. There are a number closely tied to Greater Minnesota bioscience companies, including a number which directly support our agricultural industry.
That was actually, Mr. Chairman, where I'm going with the next question. I heard you talk about buying several hundred acres out in somewhere. I don't know.
Outstate Minnesota.
Where is that?
They have not yet settled on this. Right now they are using University of Minnesota land, and this is a company that is in line for a major infusion of capital, and they have been discussing the possibility of building out a plant sciences structure where they would own their own land. They haven't been specific with us. At this point, they're just thinking, we are going to quickly outgrow the land that we are leasing from the University of Minnesota, and we are going to have to own our own farmland somewhere in the state.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to finish this. I'd be very interested in whatever kind of, bioscience or agricultural science those folks are working on. I'm really interested in the issue of genetically modifying foods and what that means, and I'm wondering if that's some of what's happening with that type of project. Is that what's being proposed, or is it something different?
Representative Clark, my understanding is that what they are doing is that they are developing new strains of seeds, but they are not genetically modifying any plants.
Thank you. That's really great news, and I'd be interested to learn some more about that.
We're not doing that.
Great. I'm happy to hear that. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not, I don't really have a question. I could throw you a half a dozen or a dozen softballs that really would make the UEL sound really well or better. What I will make sure that the committee understands is that one of the unique things about the UEL is that you don't get ongoing state funding for your accelerator, whatever you want to call it. Whereas many states in the nation, I think one of our neighbors to the east does about a $3 million a year annual appropriation to the $25 million accelerator that they built right next to one of their major universities. I know one to the west does about a million, well, the last I heard was $1.7 million a year. We don't do anything for this particular accelerator. And it is really a very needed function for the state. The only thing that's frustrating for me is that the plan for this was to put the incubator up, 50 to 100 companies, and then put the next stage for where those companies could go to till they got to the sixth or seventh or eighth year, which is essentially when these type companies really start to. They've made it. They're done. They're on their own. They're launched, as we like to say with our kids, and they're never coming back home. Thank God. But we've done this partway. and the critical mass of technology-based companies, whether it's in Wilmer, which we've done a great job out there in Wilmer, or Worthington, where we've done investments. I could name a bunch of others. We need to support that growing of critical mass, because these are jobs that pay anywhere from $55,000 to $120,000 a year, which, as a good liberal Democrat, gives me a bigger tax base. But as a good business-type person, you know, it gives the banks a little bit more to work with.
I don't think he really thinks conservatives don't like a tax base. Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question. I've read about a huge place like yours, but I was down in Austin, Texas, near the university. Do you know whether, which apparently has created an enormous corporate tax base down there, is that done by the? Was it done by the state or was it done by the University of Texas?
I went on the inner city leadership tour a couple of years ago, and my understanding is that it was not done by the state and that the University of Texas is trying to get it done. We criticize the University of Minnesota for its inability to spin off as much entrepreneurship as we would like to see them spin off. I can tell you that the University of Texas has similar, if not greater, problems in doing the same. I don't know where that incubator is at in terms of its current development state right now, but it is moving slowly. Hmm. And one of the things I would reiterate Representative Mahoney's comment here. This is a one-time ask. We will build this facility, and we will not be back before you, because we will rent this thing up, and it will stand on its own 2 feet. And we will cash flow it appropriately. So, but if you would like me to look into the University of Texas situation, I'd be happy to do that and get back to you.
Yeah. Representative Clark's got another short question.
Very short. I think I've toured this facility a number of years ago when you were first getting started. And I believe at that time you had a place where you were doing, I think, either third or fourth phase pharmaceutical research. Is that still part of this facility?
Yes. PRISM is our largest tenant still. And they maintain a very large presence in the building. And we are actually hoping to renew their lease, because they provide a very steady cash flow, and that is a balancing act. And I know I should probably stop talking at this point, but that is a balancing act. A facility like this has to maintain. People have to pay their rent. This is capitalism, and we want to make good on our promises, on our financing, and on any bonding that we might secure from the legislature.
Mr. Chairman? I would be interested in just maybe sometime a list of the pharmaceutical companies that are working with you on that utilize the lab, the pharmaceuticals.
Okay, sure.
Thank you.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. I did have to step out for a minute, so I'm sorry if I missed this. And to the testifier, I did have to step out for a minute, so I'm sorry if I missed this. If I did, in the interest of time, we can just chat afterwards. But I was just wondering if you could give me an idea of what the inside of this looks like. I've never been to an incubator before, so if you could just give me an idea of what the inside layout looks like.
It's actually an old Target distribution center that was converted in the early 2000s. It's two stories. It has a very large atrium that is used as common space among the tenants. And I would interject that an addition to this building would also improve the economics of it, because the common area maintenance costs would then be amortized over many more rent-paying tenants. But you walk into it, and there's a large open space several conference rooms which tenants are able to use, a cafeteria area which is very often used during the obviously the lunch hour. We hold receptions there. We hold we have brought in companies from overseas. We had three delegations recently from Austria, France, and I believe there was a third, I believe, from Germany, but I'm not completely sure. And two of the three delegations, sponsored by Deed, did come and visit the facility.
But it is primarily about wet lab space.
Yes, ma'am, it is. And it's mostly wet lab space, but there's this open area that you walk into, and it's surrounded on either side by these wet labs. And on and above by wet labs as well.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, many of them, many of these businesses, because they're one and two and three people, that is all they have is a room, which is why, and because of the wet labs are expensive, it makes it difficult for them to find that space anywhere else.
Hence the shared facilities and the ability to provide them with equipment they might not otherwise have to have.
Hey, Representative Mahoney, would you like to renew your motion?
I would love to renew my motion, Mr. Chair, that House File 2606.
Very well. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you for having us.
Representative Lemire. Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could move House File 2567 for possible inclusion in the bonding bill.
Very well. Tell us about it.
And being that we have such a short time, if I could have my testifier explain the project and then be open for questions.
Please give your name for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Nathan Burkett. I'm the County Administrator of Todd County. I'm here to testify in favor of House File 2567. It's the Todd County Senior Citizens Healthy Living Center. We're asking for $500,000 in the bonding bill. First thing I'd like to say is the Senior Citizens Healthy Living Center is the title, but it really is because it's dedicated to our senior citizens who have pushed us towards this. The purpose of the project is to repurpose a school building in Eagle Bend, Minnesota, to house a facility that will prepare and coordinate delivery of meals and baked goods to senior citizens who live in their homes throughout the region, nine-county region. We'll prepare and deliver meals and baked goods to institutions in the area, such as schools, jails, hospitals. It'll serve as a regional hub for the preparation and distribution of locally grown foods and offer wide-ranging opportunities for the county community and the region for senior citizens' active living opportunities. Since this is the Jobs and Economic Development Committee, I'll kind of try and keep my focus on that. But this is a project that does have the distinct advantage of being both a cost-saving opportunity and a economic development opportunity as well. So I'll focus in for just a moment on the cost-saving side of things, and then I'll hit the economic development opportunity. There's a new study out from the Central Minnesota County on Aging that said that in the year 2000, that 91% of people over the age of 65 are taken care of by family members. And the estimate is that by the year 2030, 50% of people over the age of 65 will be taken care of by their family members. And the question that we have to ask ourselves as policymakers is who's going to take care of that 50% or that 41% that's no longer taken care of by their families? Unfortunately, or depending on how you look at it, fortunately, that's going to fall to the government in certain instances. So we're trying to be proactive to provide people with the opportunity to keep themselves healthy and stay in their homes. This type of program has the opportunity to save $40,000 per person per year that stays out of the nursing home to the state. Many of these people who receive these types of services, the bundled meal services, are on medical assistance, and our deliveries keep people on their medications, provide good nutrition for them, and serve as a general welfare check. And actually, we do have a lot of instances where people who have been found and they're in poor health, and we take them to the hospital, and we've headed off major problems because people these folks aren't able to get to the hospital themselves. Now I'll focus in a little bit on the economic opportunity that exists. The other side of this project is that we are going to provide a place for local farmers to bring their foods in to process them. One of the interesting things about Minnesota's health food code is that you can't market anything to institutions, be they schools, hospitals, whatever, if they're not processed in a licensed facility. We think that this is an extraordinary opportunity for value-added agriculture, where growers in a 9 or 12 county region, depending on how far we think we can stretch this, are going to be able to bring their products into this facility, process them in a licensed facility, and move them from the field to the fork in a very efficient manner. Right now, I was speaking with, actually on the way down, I spoke with a grower from Alexandria, a grower from the from Crow Wing County, and a grower from Wadena County, who told me that they probably leave between 20 and 30% of the product that they grow in their field because they don't have a market for it. There is a market for this stuff out there. The problem is that they aren't able to bring it to the market. So the economic opportunity really lies in the fact that our growers are going to be able to bring more of their foods to market in a more efficient manner. With that, I guess finally, one of the core principles that the Todd County Board of Commissioners has adopted is that we really believe in people being able to live longer better. And in Todd County, what that means for us is keeping people in their homes. One of the great challenges, and if you're from a rural area, you understand this, is that people living in their homes means that they're going to live further than typical from services, like a grocery store even. People around the city of Eagle Bend and that live in their homes have a hard time actually getting to the grocery store because the nearest grocery store is actually 20 miles away from them. So there's challenges that arise from people living in their homes that we feel like we can head off a little bit here. So with that, I guess I'd take questions.
Any questions from the members? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, not much of a question, just a comment. I do like the idea of the local foods going to be used in what you're calling it here, farm to fork. There's also a big program around the state being attempted anyhow, is farm to schools. So would this be workable within the farm to school? And if so, again, the more we can help the farmers fill out their quotas off their fields, the better off we are. Although, I'm told the ag community hasn't had much of a recession, just us poor city folk.
Yeah. Based on $10,000 an acre land, I don't think they have either. There's one question I have. You know, you have an ethanol plant near Little Falls. Is that anywhere near where you want to do this? I don't know the geography.
35 miles or something.
By the way, it's okay. Because they do have heat and carbon dioxide that will make things grow in a greenhouse a lot faster. That's what ADM does with theirs.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney asked about farm to school. And that is one of the things, actually, if we do have a business plan done for this. If you approve this bonding, we actually do have a business plan in place that shows that this will cash flow itself. One of the things is that right off the bat, we'd be signing a contract with Eagle Valley School District, which is the cities of Clarissa and Eagle Bend, and we would be providing them with baked goods, their breads, their buns, their things like that. So yes, farm to school is an imperative part to this. I was also speaking with a grower out of Crow Wing County who provides food to the Brainerd School District, and they've actually had the opportunity to actually study whether or not it's a savings to the school district to do local foods as opposed to having a large out-of-state grower, which is typically what you get, bring them in, and actually found that there is a relatively significant savings in having the local grower bring the food into the school district as opposed to trucking it in.
Representative Mahoney.
Be really quick. Our Department of Health and Human Services, or Department of Human Services, I believe it is, or Department of Health has done another study in the same fashion. But I'm more concerned, and it's not a question for here, is how do we get more vegetables into those school lunches and stuff, and rather than breads and bakery goods, because bakery goods, as much as I like them, and probably aren't the best thing for our kids to be eating.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we'll get there. That's the goal. It's just for now, in order to cash flow, we know we start with that. So,
Representative Lemire, would you like to renew your motion?
I would like to add one other thing. I don't know if the administrator mentioned it or not, but the county has agreed to match the state portion. So, yes, Mr. Chair, members, I renew my motion that House File 2567 be laid over for possible inclusion in the bonding bill.
We'll do that. Thank you very much for a good presentation. It's a great project. Maybe you can sell foods to Whole Foods. They buy all their stuff from California. I think we are adjourned.